So basically half of the talk will be convincing you of this, and then the second half will be using this. Okay. So my setup will be one massive scalar with G2 symmetry. So this is like lambda 5-4 theory. But the results will be general, okay? So it's any quantum field theory with one massive particle in a spectrum. Okay, that's the idea. And also, I mean, this is people in the 60s started working on this because of pion scattering, which was a scalar with G2 symmetry, was a pseudoscalar, right? So that's also why the results are in that case. So the outline. So first I will just tell you about the S-Mesis Bootstrap idea. So I mean, many of you already heard about this, but just so we are in the same footing, I think there are also like PSI students here. But I'll tell you a bit about these constraints. Then I'm going to tell you about two-particle unitarity, okay? So basically, most of the work in the S-Mesis Bootstrap right now and in the past was based on two-particle unitarity. And so I'm going to tell you like a few old results. Basically, one of them is that the Landau curves, for example, if you have already heard about them, that appear in Feynman diagrams, they are actually non-perturbative singularities of the amplitude. And Mendelssohn showed this in 1958. Then I'm going to tell you something about an object, which is this double discontinuity. I will be a bit more specific. And there is a region in kinematic space where this is bigger than zero, this object. And then from these two ideas, you can prove a theorem, a very important theorem in quantum field theory, which is that you must have particle production in D larger than 2. So in D equals 2, we know that there are some integral theories, right? But in D larger than 2, this is actually, you really have to have particle production, okay? So this was by Axe in '65. And then I'm going to tell you a bit about my work. And so basically, yeah, multiparticle unitarity remains a big challenge today. And there are not many results. So we were able just to fill the first point, basically to check the first point on the Landau curves. And this was last year with Amit Sever and Sasha Zhiboidov. Okay. So, yeah. Okay, so let me tell you, I think it's fine if I write here, right?
You can also move the podium if we need.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Okay, so yeah, let me just tell you a bit about the S-Mesis Bootstrap. Yeah, so the basic idea is that, of course, just very basic, you have an S-matrix operator which you decompose into an interacting part. You bracket two particle states with operator, and you factor out some 2 pi to the 4, some delta function, and some object, which is the object you want to study. In this case, I'm going to write S channel. And S channel because, well, I have here, when I put these two particle state, I have particle 1, 2, 3, and 4, right? And S is P1 plus P2 squared. So it's coming here in the S channel. They are scattering in this way. They also have T, which is P1 minus P3. So these are Lorentz invariants. And so Lorentz invariants implies that this object must depend on these two variables. OK. So the first constraint is analyticity. So analyticity tells you that this object here is actually the boundary value of some function in the complex plane. So, some function where I should approach. Basically, I have to include some I epsilon here. It's the Feynman prescription. I will show you why you should include some I epsilon. But this tells you that in fact you should you should approach the real axis from above. Okay, so this is just some prescription, okay? And so basically there is some domain in the complex plane where you have some function and then you go to the real axis from above and then you have some you get the physical object that you are interested in. Okay? So now this combines very nicely with another property, which is unitarity. Okay? Unitarity just tells you that, well, SS dagger is equal to 1. So this follows from just that all the scattering outcomes must add up to 1, right? When I just a basic quantum mechanics. But for the operator, implies this relation. And then if you use this, you get something like terms of T, like this. And then I can, well, to make use of this equation, I should bracket with two particle states or many particle states. But if we want to get some condition on our object, on the 222 amplitude, you should just bracket with two particle states. So when you do this, you find P1, P2. P3, P4, P2. Okay. So on the left-hand side, it's going to be a bit fast, but what you'll find is that here you can express this as the difference of S plus I epsilon T minus T of S minus I epsilon of T. Okay. This object. So let me write it like this, and then here I insert the identity. Okay, I insert the complete set of states. So I have k1, kn, k1, kn, and here. Okay. So when you do this, you'll get many contributions, right? Well, the first one will be a two-particle state because I assume Z2 symmetry. So in principle, you could have one particle state. This would correspond to a pole. The first one you get is a two-particle state. So when you do this, what you'll get is very roughly, you get S of S minus 4m squared, some integral square. So this is very rough equation. Okay, I'm not going to be specific. And then, well, this comes from putting the two particle state here. So this would be, if I write this like this, so k1, k2, k1, k2, plus then k1, k4, k1, k4. So you have to add all of this, right? And so the first one will give you something that depends on the amplitude itself, which is the two particle. The two, right? And then you have the four particle state, and the four particle state only becomes accessible when you have enough energy to produce these four particles. So then you have another contribution, which has a theta function, and now it depends on 2 to 4 squared. Okay. Yeah. So the one part in principle you could include the one particle states. But I have Z2 symmetry, so I'm not gonna.
You have one particle states in this region.
Yeah. So if you are thinking about the physical object in the S channel, so S must be above 4m squared. This will not have support, right? But if you think about the complex plane, you can take S below 4, and then this will give you a delta function, which is exactly a pole. So yes, in principle, well. If you just focus on S bigger than 4, yeah, you don't have the one particle state. If you just are willing to assume more about the complex plane, then you can go lower. And in fact, you really find the pole that you find in just computing finite diagrams. Yeah.
There are one particle states in the identity, but they overlap with T and P2 is 0.
They overlap with T, the T and the two particle state. It will be something, well, it will be 0 if you are above S bigger than 4. But in principle, it can be like a three particle. Off-shell process. It will be like a residue, a three-point coupling.
Is T a real function?
T? If T, yeah, T is a real Well, T is a function in the complex plane, but you're right, it satisfies something about, yeah, something that about being real, which is the following, that T star epsilon is equal to T S minus I epsilon. So I needed to use this to go from here to here. You're right. So it satisfies this relation. If you complex conjugate the function, it's the same as taking the same function but complex conjugating the argument.
That just comes from unitarity.
No, that this is comes from CPT actually, was proven by Olive in 62. So this is a, but I mean if you do Feynman diagrams and of course the Lagrangian all the couplings are real. This is about it's about that, yeah. So I mean yeah, of course the properties I'm telling you here, you can just do Feynman diagrams and then you find that they are obeyed, right? Okay, but okay, fair enough. So let me just tell you a bit what this equation means. It's a bit weird, right? Yeah. So since we have a function, a complex function, right, in the complex plane, let me just plot here the complex plane in S. So we have something similar in T. Okay. And now this is an equation for the difference of this object in the real axis, right? So this computes a difference here. So and this tells me that this difference is not zero. So this means that the function is not smooth. It's so this what this tells you. What you should think about is this is some discontinuity. We call this the discontinuity. And this equation tells you that discontinuity is not zero. It's actually different than zero. And it starts. You have a contribution at 4m squared. I should put a branch point. This would be a branch point at 4m squared. That goes on, right? And then you have another branch point at 16. I should put it like this. Okay. And now there's already something non-trivial that you can check. So if you do Feynman diagrams, for example, you will find this kind of thing. For example, what is the simplest Feynman diagram which has a branch cut at 4m squared? That would be this diagram here, where I have a two-particle exchange. And I take the imaginary part, I cut through these two legs, and I get the branch cut. So if you just compute this Feynman diagram, you see that it exactly has this behavior. It's analytic, and it has a branch cut above 4m squared. And in the same way here, you'd also get, now you need the equivalent diagram, but with four particles being exchanged. OK, okay, fair enough. So now let me just tell you about the last property, which is crossing. Now crossing is just very simple. That in fact my function is permutation invariant in the arguments. Okay, in principle there should also be U, another Mendelssohn invariant, but U I mean is related to S and T, and let me not go there. Okay, so now if you have crossing, everything that we said here also applies to T. So this means that in the T plane I should also have a branch cut from 4m squared infinity, and another branch cut from 16m squared. Okay, and now here I have some. Now here, because remember T corresponds to scattering in this direction, this would be, for example, a Feynman diagram which would give this would be this one. Okay. Yeah. Are there questions here? So now what I'm going to tell you is how these three properties combine to give you something non-trivial, okay? Just to give you something non-trivial, okay? So the first thing you might wonder is, well, I have an analytic function of two variables. I can take the discontinuity in these arguments, right? I have an equation for the discontinuity. So I can do disk S, T of S T. This would be something like cutting through the S channel like this. I could do the same thing in T, right? T. So why not just taking them both at the same time? So why not considering an object which is this S, this T. So in principle, I have a function in the complex plane of both variables. So in principle, I could take this operation, right? So now, what are the properties of this object? This is called a double spectral density, OK? So the properties of this is, well, let's think about, let me just erase this. Well, from the single discontinuities, we can probably tell something already about this row.
How is this different from the Steinman relations? Like, shouldn't this be zero?
Okay, you are getting there. Yeah, but this is stronger than Steinman relations. Okay, I will. I mean, this object, I mean, it will obey some constraints to the Steinman relations, but Steinman relations will be weaker than what we are going to do. Okay. Yeah. Let me actually. I need a bigger. Okay, so let me draw this S and T plane. Now let me put the normal thresholds that we already found. Okay, so these are called normal thresholds. Okay, these branch cuts. Okay. So I add here 2 particle exchange. I add a 4 particle. Here I would have 6 particles. Okay. Okay. So what this object is computing is the difference here, right? In both cases, we are taking the discontinuity in both the branch cuts. So you'd expect that this would be proportional to S bigger than 4m squared, T bigger than 4m squared. Well, you know for sure that if you take one of them, if you slide one of them outside the cut, you just get 0 because one of the discs will be 0, right? So you expect that you'd have something non-zero above this, in this square. So naively, you'd expect that rho is different than 0 here, right? So we can test this idea, right? So we can test this. How do we test this? We can use Feynman diagrams. So what would be a Feynman diagram which would give me something non-zero for this object? Well, these ones you cannot use, because what you need is you need to cut in both channels. And well, in this case, you just have, for these bubble diagrams, you just have like a cut in one of the channels, right? I cannot cut through here. So you need something that you can cut on both sides. So one example would be, for example, the box diagram. So I'm here a bit relaxing the Z2 assumption. What I'm saying is general, OK? But this would be one example. Why? Because I can just take a cut here, and I can take a cut here. And then you take this, and then you check. So is it true that the double disk starts having starts being non-zero after this? And the answer is that it's no. It's not. Okay. The answer is that actually rho is 0 in this corner here. And this is what Steinman relations means. But actually, it's 0 above some curve here. Or it's non-zero above this curve, and below this curve, it's 0. So this is called the Landau curve. So quantum field theory just seems like perturbation theory just doesn't like this argument. just give you something non-trivial. It's an algebraic curve, okay? But since I'm doing like 5-4, this diagram should not be there. So what would be the simplest one in 5-4 would be just, for example, adding two legs here. And in this case, I have quartic vertices everywhere. But by doing this, you see that you are exchanging now four particles in the T channel. So this means that this must be above T must be above 16 m squared to have support. Yeah.
What's the statement of Simon relations? It's just that overlapping very shortly at the threshold.
Simon relations tell you that the overlap of these conditions that scatter in the if you have an overlapping variable in the same channel, it tells you that the discontinuity overlap discontinuity is zero.
It holds there but not there.
Yeah, which I think, yeah, I thought this was time related, but I think maybe it's not. You're right, because I cannot use S and T at the same time. But I think there is a similar argument that shows that in this neighborhood, it's zero, yeah. And I thought it was related to Steinman relation. But yeah, I'm not sure.
So is the crossing relation only hold for when S and T are real?
No, the crossing relation holds everywhere.
So it's basically but T S T is like rigorously it's a function on the two,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, except this branch cut. Yeah.
So that means like this T disk S is same as this S disk.
Yes. You can exchange the order. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So okay. What you find for this diagram is a different thing. You find something that asymptotes to 16. You find this kind of curve here. So this would be this diagram. And well, if I use crossing, I should also have another curve that does this. And this would be just symmetrizing this diagram, just making a reflection, okay? So you get that rho is non-zero after these curves in perturbation theory. So now the question is, can we prove this? Is this an artifact of perturbation theory, or is it something that is really true for the non-perturbative amplitude? So that's the question that Mandelson answered. Okay, so what is the idea? What is the idea? So the idea is that you want some equation for rho, right? But we already have an equation for the single disk. I told you that we have an equation for the single disk. That's some contributions, so 2-4. Okay, and now we don't know much about this object, so the idea is that, well, if I take S below 16, this term does not contribute. So if I take S below 16, I cannot exchange four particles, so in principle, my problem is a bit simpler. So I can erase this. And so the idea is that, well, at least let's focus on this region until 16. And now let's try, well, here, even just by focusing for on S below 16, we still have some non-trivial support for the double disk. So in principle, this equation here should already give me some information about this Landau curve. Okay? So let me erase what I have here, because now we are doing non-perturbative to field theory. So we are going to focus here, this region. And now the idea is that you want an equation for rho, so you want to take the discontinuity in T of this equation. So you want to take disk T of this equation, okay? So this equation is an equation like this. The problem is that this is not that easy to do, because you require to have you see, on the left-hand side, you have something which you can take the discontinuity, which is this amplitude. But on the right-hand side, the dependence in T is not analytic. There is some kernel here inside. Yeah, so let me be more specific. So you have T here, and then you have some dependence on the T's, individual T's of these sub-amplitudes, T1 and T2. And then you need the kernel, which combines them and integrates over T1 and T2 and gives you some dependence on T. The problem is that this kernel has a theta function. It has some theta function of some polynomial. And you cannot analytically, I mean, you cannot take the discontinuity of a theta function. You have to analytically continue this object. Okay? So I don't have time to tell you how you do this, but this was what Mandelson did. The idea is that you explore analyticity in T1 and T2. So you write a Cauchy formula for these subamplitudes. Then you are able to find an analytic formula for this kernel. So when you do this, you find some equation for rho. So you find some equation for rho. Disk T, disk S, T. Now this equation schematically is of the following form. You have the cut that you had before, but now you also have a cut on the T channel of each of these sub-amplitudes. So you get something which depends on the discontinuity in T of each of these objects. So you get something that very roughly depends on disk T1 of T of ST1 times disk T2 of T of S2. Okay? And then you have some theta function here. You put L and T2. Okay. So this is the idea, okay? So now what we have to do, so yeah, very roughly, of course, you have something that depends on the discontinuity in the T channel. And now you see that there is some non-trivial support for the double disk. You have this theta function, which is only true for T bigger than some function of T1 and T2. And this function, it grows with T1 and T2. So the contribution, the support of rho is defined when T1 and T2 are the smallest. Okay? And they are the smallest when the discontinuity in T1 and T2 get support, which is exactly in the two-particle exchange. Okay, I'll be more specific about this. Okay? I'll be more clear. Okay. So, yeah, let me erase the thing on top. Better to draw some pictures. So we have, you remember here, in the T channel, I have many contributions, these normal thresholds. So this is exactly what I should put here. This would be a two-particle exchange plus a four-particle exchange. Here, the same two-particle exchange. So this T1 and T2 will start, this is continuing, will start have supporting, will start having support when T1 and T2 are just bigger than 4m squared. Okay, so when you plug this, you find exactly this curve, which has a formula. So this will be 16 squared, yes, 4m squared. Okay. And now you can see why. I mean, you are just gluing these two bubble exchanges in the T channel. So what you are doing here is really just this diagram here. Except that you are not specifying what is this vertex here. So it's kind of, so this is why it's non-perturbative. Okay. Just have some two-particle exchanges, and that's it. Okay. So then with this argument, Mandelson showed that rho is only non-zero above this curve. Yeah. Are there questions here?
You said this diagram, but you meant the amplitude.
I mean the amplitude, yes. Yeah, just that the diagram characterizes the singularity, yes. It's the amplitude, yeah. So yeah, so the idea, what is the idea? Let me summarize. You start with unitarity in the S channel, and then you take a discontinuity of this object. You find that this discontinuity depends on the discontinuities of each of these individual amplitudes in the T channel. And they are convoluted with some kernel. And this kernel has some non-trivial support, which comes automatically from this procedure. And then you plug whenever these guys have a branch cut, it will give you a contribution to the double disk. And the initial, well, the starting point is exactly the two particle exchange. So that's how you get the non-zero row above this curve. So now you can be a bit more creative. You can keep going, right? Because T-channel unitarity is not just a two-particle exchange; it's also four-particle exchange. So in principle, I could use in this formula also, for example, 16 m squared and 4 m squared. And these would combine, for example, this exchange with this four-particle exchange with this two-particle exchange. And what you find now is another curve, which does this somewhere. And this would be the curve that you'd get from the Feynman diagram, which is this one. Okay. So you see that there is a
white curve always above the white curve, or no?
This one is above this one, yes. Yeah, because it must asymptote to 36 m squared, because you are exchanging. It must be above 36 m squared, because you are exchanging six particles in the T channel. So to produce, to start to have double disk, you need the
close to 4 m squared. It's also above the white
one. Yeah. You're right. Yes. Yeah, you're right. So it's close to 4 m squared. You can show there is some onion structure, which suggests that this function is really simple in terms of T1 and T2. So that's okay. I mean, so now it seems like we can just keep going and playing this game, and we have a whole tower of Landau curves, right? So it's, you can just start having fun with this. And now, another thing is that non-trivial thing is that you see that this is an equation which couples the amplitude itself. So you have the double discontinuity of the amplitude depends on the amplitude itself. So in principle, this will be whatever we learn about the double disk. It should also have an effect on these individual pieces here. So what I mean is that this object here will also develop a double disk at some point. This will get some imaginary part, this discontinuity in T. It will get an imaginary part exactly when this guy itself reaches this Landau curve here. So what I mean here is that here you should put also this contribution here. Let me put with an I. Because this guy here will also develop an imaginary part. Okay? Because you are for s above 4, and you are also integrating T1 above this region. So you are integrating here. So this means that, so in other words, we are integrating these kernels in T1. So you start hitting first the 4 m squared threshold. And this gives you this Landau curve for the amplitude. But then you integrate here. You go to the 16 m squared threshold. You get this Landau curve. But then you can also eat the Landau curve itself. So that's why this is coupled together. So then what you should have is, for example, a combination of this diagram with this guy here. And this would give you another curve, which would be above. And the curve corresponds to this diagram, precisely. Was this clear, or are there questions? So the idea is that you have an equation that, just from the normal thresholds, just couples these normal thresholds, glues them together with some kernel, gives you some double discontinuity, some other singularities. Then you plug these singularities back, and you get the whole procedure. You get an echo of all these singularities, which are these Landau curves. So this is the idea. What do you mean? Yeah, this is everything that can happen. Yeah, in this region, it's all you can have. So these are all the Landau curves. So these are all the singularities in this region. And of course, you do Feynman diagrams, and you find all of this, right? So now, okay. So that's interesting. We found some singularities.
So for example, for that diagram upright, you would have a product of three disks under integration. T1, T2, T3.
Yeah, for this guy, well, this guy you'd have exactly. This guy would have some contribution. You'd get some imaginary part of rho of ST of this with this early contribution, which itself you use this equation again. So you have inside this, you have again this disk T again of this smaller diagrams, as you say. So you're saying that I plug this here, and this double disk itself then also has contribution of this. So you just iterate this equation. You just plug it back. Yeah, exactly. So okay. So now what can we say? I mean, this is why is this, why should you care about this? Why is this important? Well, you can say something more about this row. Okay, you can show that row is positive between these two curves. So this was the argument by Mahu and Martin in 64, so that you can have row bigger than zero here. And the argument, this will be a bit more technical, but the idea is to prove this positivity is how people prove this, that these Wilson coefficients are positive nowadays. You just use the fact that this piece here is positive in some region. Okay. In fact, well, I can use a partial wave decomposition. It's what's called the partial wave decomposition. So the idea is that you decompose into angular momentum states, and you have some imaginary part of some partial amplitude, and you have some Legendre polynomial. Okay. So the idea here is that you, instead of using t, you use angular momentum, so you can do this decomposition.
The argument should be s. Or the partial wave. The argument of the partial wave.
No, it should be t, because I want to take the discontinuity in t. So I want to take the imaginary part in t. So I mean the t channel.
The anomaly, t and s are solved, right?
No, they are correct. S is an angle and t is the energy. So
the idea is that
the idea is that this is positive. This is positive. This comes from unitarity in these angular momentum states. Okay, so I mean I don't have time to explain, but basically you have SS dagger equal to 1, right? But I can diagonalize this operator by using these angular momentum states, and this becomes a simple relation for S of j squared. And then you can express this S in terms of F, and then you find that this imaginary part is positive. Okay, so that's basically the idea. And now also you have the Legendre polynomial, which is also positive when the argument is bigger than 1. Okay, and this is what, and this is true because S is bigger than 4 and T is bigger than 4, so this is true. So this is also positive. So you find that this is positive, so rho is positive. Well, you cannot go too fast because you have to make sure that this sum makes sense. Okay, so this sum stops converging exactly when this guy develops a singularity. This guy develops a singularity exactly in the Landau curve. So this was a bit too fast, but the idea is that this develops an imaginary part at some point, which is this rho. And this develops an imaginary part exactly when you go here. So this means that, well, when you take this one, the radius of convergence of this series, which is this one, and you combine it with the lowest element on the other side, you get exactly this curve. So and that's why you have some rho being positive between these two curves. Okay. So if this is a bit too technical, just believe me that rho is positive here, okay? And now I will derive some non-trivial consequences about this, okay? Okay, so now are there questions? Okay, so believe me that rho is positive, okay? Now we try to dare going below, above, well, let's try to get outside this region. So one way to get outside this region is to use crossing, right? Because I just took S between 4 and 16, but in principle, everything that I concluded here should also apply for the t variable. So in principle, I should have exactly the same picture for the t variable. Yeah.
So the discontinuity is positive in that region for the left case. For the right case, but also have a kernel, right?
Yeah, the kernel is positive. Yeah. It's a square root. Yeah. Kernel is positive, yeah. So now, I mean, now we use crossing and we conclude we are able to go a bit farther, so at, in T, right? We still don't know what's going on here. So now the argument that to prove that you must have a particle production in D larger than 2 is the following. You assume that you don't have particle production. So if you assume that you don't have particle production, this formula or rho applies everywhere. Right? So in other words, I can take this and push it, right? So then I have more information. I can extend these curves all the way, and here the same. Right? So now you have a combination of Landau curves that they cross each other, and you have an equation for this side, like from for the S channel. So when you look at scattering from left to right, and you have a similar equation in the T channel. So you have two equations. Now the problem is that the equation in the S channel tells you that rho should be zero below this curve. But on the other side, we just concluded that rho must be positive. So there is a contradiction here. And now what you can ask is, well, is it possible to, well, now it's, you have a very non-trivial constraint on rho, on the amplitude, and you cannot, the only way to solve this constraint is, that, is if the amplitude is zero, if it's trivial. So yeah, that's the argument. So what we show is that two-particle unitarity, analyticity, and crossing are not compatible. That's what we showed. So basically, this set of function tells you that you cannot have nothing here below this curve. But then you apply crossing, and then you see that you should have actually something positive, right? And then you have some non-trivial, you have some clash, right?
So which one is right?
Which, I mean, the only way they are both right is if the amplitude is zero. If you assume that there is no particle production, the only way they are both right is if, it's, if the amplitude is zero. So, yeah. So we dared to try to find an amplitude which satisfies two-particle unitarity, analyticity, and crossing, and we failed. Right? So this means that, OK, well, now we have to really go back and consider production. Okay, so we have to consider multiparticle unitarity. Okay. Okay. So now the question is, yeah, can we go a bit higher? Can we go a bit higher in this plot? Can we try to find what's here? So this is exactly what I have in this plot here. So it's better. So if you want to look here, is a bit better. Okay. So I should have told you something before so that you care about this object. I hope I didn't lose you in the meantime. But this object is important for the bootstrap because you can get the amplitude from it. It's called the Mandelsam representation. And it's this formula. So this is a formula which has several assumptions that let me not go into that. But this is a double dispersion relation. It comes from exploring analyticity in both variables. You write a Cauchy formula, you blow up these contours, and then you are able to describe the amplitude in terms of this double discontinuity. Okay. So now the point is that to use this formula, you need to know the support of rho.
No.
This is local. If it's zero, so you go to this region, you equate this formula to zero. And you, if since the kernel is positive, the only way this is zero is if this is zero. Then you use this, and you show, okay, now this must be zero. Individually, this is positive. All of the imaginary part of partial must be zero. And then you use unitarity, f of j squared, and then you find that f of j must be zero. And since this is a non-compact region, it is true for all energy. So that's how you complete the argument. Okay, so to use this formula, you have to know the support of rho, right? So to use this formula, so imagine, I mean, this formula captures analyticity and crossing, and then you can write an ansatz for rho to satisfy to impose unitarity. Okay, well, but to use it, I mean, you should know the support, right? And the support is non-trivial, as you can see. It has some curve here where it's positive. There is another curve here where it's positive. But then you have this corner, very annoying corner, where you don't know what happens. So you could use something very very strange, which is you take the Landau curve and you put this corner, and then you do this, right? So that's why it's important that we are able to look into here and see what's going on. Okay. So and for 60 years we didn't know what is the support of rho, for example, because multiparticle unitarity is very difficult. But okay, so let's try to redo all of these arguments, and now let's try to go here.
Sorry, Miguel.
Yeah.
The same argument that made you rule out the point, the intersection point between the two lines at 4m squared. Didn't you use it also to rule out the point at 16m squared? This vertex of this weird wedge you are having.
Yeah, I mean this argument. I don't know. I have to be honest. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know this argument. I heard that there is, I mean, I think you have, there is some perturbative argument which Hoffi and collaborators at IS, they have an argument, but I don't really understand this argument. I mean, yeah, there's, but the thing is, okay, even, okay, let's say you do that. Let's say you are able to show that it's zero in a neighborhood. What is the size of this neighborhood? Is it here? Maybe then you don't know what's a gap, so I mean, it doesn't buy you much. Okay, so okay, so now let's try to. Oh, I'm a bit too late already. Sorry, but I started late also, right? I started 5 minutes. Okay, so let's. So what happens if we try to do the same thing, but we take s above 16? Okay, so now. Yeah, what happens if you write unitarity, and as before, we had this two-particle exchange, 4m squared, and now you also consider the 2 to 4. So now, I mean, it should be enough to restrict ourselves below 36. Since we are just, we just want to go here and look at what's here, in principle, we can just take s below 36. So this would be that there would be no contributions like 2 to 6, would be 0. So we just take the next logical step in the previous argument and just consider the 2 to 4 term. Okay. So now the question is, can we take the discontinuity in T of this equation? And this is extremely hard to do because this 2 to 4 depends on 9 invariants. We don't know anything about the its properties, like in the complex plane. It has, yeah, this is an object which we don't know much. And then there is also a kernel, some kernel here, which is very hard to continue. Okay, this is a kernel which has some theta functions in T. It's very hard to analytically continue. Okay, so this is something I'm looking right now with Sebastian Miseri and Hoffi Hannes Dottir. And But to be honest, I'm not even sure we should be trying, because if Gribov couldn't do it, I'm not sure we should even try it. But okay. So this is a very hard problem in this way. I hope that at this point I already convinced you that these Feynman integrals contain some non-perturbative information. In particular, singularities of Feynman integrals or Feynman diagrams seem to be singularities of the non-perturbative amplitude. These Landau curves, I could have found them just by computing Feynman diagrams and see where they are singular. Okay, so one idea would be, well, let's try to learn about these Landau curves just by thinking about Feynman diagrams, which involve 4 particle exchanges in both channels. Right. So I want something which is here. So it has some 4 particle exchange both in the S channel and in the T channel. So what would be one diagram? That would be here. Well, one diagram would be, for example, this one, right? So it has four particles here, has four particles here. And indeed, if you compute this, you find some Landau curve here. Okay, and this Landau curve has the formula, the following formula. Okay, so this is one example. I think it's the simplest example of a Landau curve in the multiparticle region, right? So now, since we are peaking here, let me continue these curves. Okay, so these curves in principle continue over here. Right. And then what we want to find, so what is a concrete question is, we want to find if there is any Landau curve that does this, for example. If there is a Landau curve in the multiparticle that does this, then it contributes to the support of rho. If there isn't, then the support of rho is defined by the previous curves that we just discovered. Right. So that is the question. Can we find the Landau curves in this region? So you might wonder, is it possible to compute this diagram? This diagram, I don't think it's even possible to compute. There's a lot of loops. So how do we know the curve? So how do we know where this diagram is singular if I cannot compute it? Well, there is a way to compute these singularities without computing the integral, and this was a paper by Landau in 1960, which gave us a set of equations to compute these curves. And that's why the curves have his name. These are called Landau equations. And the Landau equations take some diagram and give you some curve. But even the Landau equations are very hard to solve. So let me just give you an idea of what are the Landau equations. So you take all particles on shell. So you take ki. So all particles in the diagram, you put them to some mass. Then you apply momentum conservation. Momentum conservation at each vertex. And the third rule is a bit more tricky, is the loop equation.
Special that happens when the Landau curves intersect?
No, they add up, like, so the double disk adds up.
Like, trying to identify where those
were. Yeah, I mean, you could. What you're saying is actually something non-trivial, which is, in principle, this Landau curve here should be reproduced by unitarity in the S channel. So this term here should be able to reproduce this Landau curve, exactly because this Landau curve it was this diagram. And in principle, I have a four-particle cut here. So in principle, this four-particle term should reproduce the Landau curve coming from crossing the 222 case, so crossing this. So that's something non-trivial about QFT. It achieves whatever kernel you write, you know that it must reproduce this. So whatever 224 term we have, it must be somehow be able to reproduce the crossing of the S-channel. Curve, yeah. So, okay. So the loop equation is something which is, you should take every loop and then you add this product. Okay. So for example, just for the box diagram, you'd have some alpha one k one, alpha two k two, alpha three k three, four k four. And you should add them up. So these alphas are some, in Feynman integrals, they are Feynman parameters or Schwinger parameters. And well, this is what comes when you put denominators together, you introduce parameters. But you should think about them as some proper time, if you want. And you multiply proper time with momentum, this gives you some space-time displacement. And what this equation is telling you is that the space-time displacement from two points does not depend on the path. It's the same from going here and going here. So this is what intuitively the Landau equation is telling you. So the Landau equation is basically telling you that you should imagine the diagram as actually some on-shell process of scattering, okay? So this is what the Landau equations are telling you, okay? And the Landau curves, if you solve these equations, the Landau curves appear when the alphas are positive. So let me just make this statement. So Landau curves are these alphas being positive. Okay. So yeah, just having positive proper times. Okay. In principle, there are other singularities of the Landau equations, but so this is what we want to find. So in other words, we want to consider Feynman diagrams which have these four particle exchanges, and we want to find the Landau solutions to Landau equations where the alphas are positive. So that's the statement. Okay. So yeah, so I'm really late. So let me show you. So because I was anticipating I was getting late, I'm shifting to slides. Okay. So let me show you one way of getting these Landau equations, because before there was, I mean, I don't think there was any automated way to compute these Landau equations, because it's even, I mean, you take a diagram, you have to write all of these by hand, or you can just write a code that does it for you. Okay. So this is one example. We know the solution. We know the solution. So at the crossing symmetric point 20, it gives me 20. So so and you see that it works. And these x's are these alphas. Okay. I can show you some more examples. Yeah, actually, let me take this. So I can show you some more examples. You see here, and these are very large diagrams. In particular, there's a Russian paper from the 60s that argues that this does not have a solution, but we actually found it has a solution. So that was interesting. Huh? They just said it doesn't have a solution. There was no argument, really. Okay. So to make it quick, what is the idea? So now we have a quick way to get the Landau equations, diagrams, right? But now the problem is that there is a small problem, which is that there are infinitely many diagrams. So, I mean, if we want to make a non-perturbative argument, you should consider all the diagrams and then see where they are, where the Landau curves are, right? So to get away from this, what? Well, at this point, I showed you that, before we showed that in the elastic region, all these Landau curves that I found are also in Feynman diagrams. Right? So I'm assuming that this is true also here. And I mean, when I talk about Feynman diagrams, I don't mean the bare mass. I mean really the mass of the asymptotic state. So what you think should think about these diagrams is really some. If you consider all the Feynman diagrams. Yeah, but each of these the point is that each of these diagrams has a singularity of the non-perturbative amplitude. No, they are not perturbative singularities. Here, I can show that they are not. Right? I just showed this. Yeah, but you see, I'm not using Feynman diagrams. I'm using these Landau equations, which tell me singularities of Feynman diagrams, but they also tell you singularities of the amplitude. Here, clearly, they give. I mean, of course, the mass I'm considering here is not the mass that would appear in a Feynman diagram. It's really the physical mass. And if I consider the physical mass in this region, I literally have the Landau curves that I would find from solving this equation. Yeah, I mean, this is my gapped. Yeah, there is no IR. There's no IR problem. I mean, I don't even know how to define an IR finite S matrix. So, yeah. So that's why. Okay, if you are not convinced, it's fine. I mean, it's an assumption. It's an assumption. I mean, here clearly it's true that this is the case. You can solve Landau equations for these diagrams. You find exactly Landau curves. So, in other words, the way we see it is like Feynman diagrams characterize these singularities. They just, that's it. I mean, there are many other Feynman diagrams which have the same Landau curves. These are the smallest ones. They characterize the singularity. Yeah, it's a gap. It's a gap. It's a gap theory. Yeah. So the CFT in the R is trivial. Yeah. So yes.
The vertices here are some unknown things.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So, yeah, but thanks for the question. Yeah. So, okay. So we have to find these Feynman diagrams. I mean, in principle, you should consider all the Feynman diagrams because these are in principle should give you all the Landau curves. But let's focus on this region, okay? So if I focus on this square, maybe the problem is simpler. Because in principle, I mean, that was our expectation, and this is really no argument, and you see it's going to be false, actually. But you'd expect there would be a finite number of curves here. And why is that? Because if you do the same in the elastic region, if I just take a finite kinematic region, there is a Landau curve here. If I do here, there is three Landau curves that cross this region. And if you keep going, there's always a finite number of curves for every finite kinematic region. So that's why we'd expect that if you focus on this finite kinematic region, there would only be a finite number of curves. And if there is a finite number of curves, there is a finite number of diagrams. So in principle, the problem becomes feasible, that you should consider a finite number of diagrams. So now the question is, which diagrams would give you a Landau curve here? Okay. So this was really the fun part of the project. And unfortunately, I don't have time to explain. But there are two key ideas. So let me just tell you these ideas, and I'll show you the results. Okay. So first idea is that we should be below 6-particle threshold. Okay. So this means that, well, I just erased, but I told you that the Landau equations put every particle on shell. So this means that I should intuitively have energy to produce all the particles in the diagram. So I should have energy in S and T to be able to put these particles on shell. What I mean by this is just I want to find a graph theoretic requirement that tells me if this diagram would give a Landau curve here or not. So what I want is restrict myself to diagrams which have 4-particle cuts. So if I have a 6-particle cut, it means that I have energy above 36. I want to restrict myself below this threshold. So in other words, I want to impose this criterion, which is, I can cut through all the legs with 4-particle cuts. Okay. And you see that, for example, this diagram here satisfies this relation, right? I can cut through all the legs with 4-particle cuts. I have one 4-particle cut here and here, and I was able to cut through all the legs. Okay. And so you'd expect that when you take larger and larger diagrams, these diagrams, to put these particles on shell, for example, let me make this cut. To put these particles on shell, I need to cut through a lot of particles. So this means that I need a lot of energy to produce them. Okay, so this is the part where it's not very rigorous. Okay, I did not prove this. I'm just telling you some intuition, and then I will show you the results of this intuition. Okay. So because proving this would require exactly doing the analytic continuation of unitarity, which we could not do, and Gribov could not do, right? So we have to assume something here. Okay, so this is the assumption, and it's a very sharp graph theoretical criterion. I give you a graph, you tell me, well, what are all the 4-particle cuts? I do the 4-particle cuts, I take the union. If this gives me all the edges, then it means it's a valid graph. If I cannot cut through some legs with 4-particle cuts, then I cannot put these particles on shell, so I don't care about this diagram. Okay, so that's one criterion. Oh yeah, actually, let me just keep it here. Okay. So the second criterion is that is something a bit more abstract, but it's actually very simple in the end. So give me 5 minutes. So. The second argument is the following. You see that these Landau curves here, they are very few compared to the number of diagrams you have at that order in perturbation theory. So for example, in this region there is only this diagram, which gives this curve, right? But at this order in perturbation theory, there are many other diagrams. Like I have these triangle diagrams, I have these, a bunch of other things. The point is that these diagrams do not give you a Landau curve here. And in fact, the number of Landau curves we see in the elastic region are just this kind of chain, like this ladder type of diagrams. So this means that a lot of the diagrams do not give you a curve there, and also a lot of the diagrams do not even have a Landau curve. Okay, so that's one fact that we understood, is that it's a very basic fact, is that when you try to run this program on many diagrams, you see that it doesn't give you a solution. And this is just not numerical, it just doesn't have a Landau curve. I mean, an alpha positive solution. So I mean, Landau curves are polynomial, they have a lot of all these solutions. What I mean is solutions with alpha positive. That's what I mean. And it becomes unlikely. So the statement is that the larger a graph is, the more unlikely it is to have an alpha positive solution. The Landau equation, the more unlikely it is to have a Landau curve. Okay? And so then we were scratching our heads for a long time trying to understand could we explain this? Is there an argument to explain this? And if there is such an argument, is there a tool that we can use to discard these kind of trivial diagrams? Okay? And the argument is very simple. The Landau equations for the big graph contain all the Landau equations of every subgraph. So every subgraph here, for example, let me focus on this corner here. I have a loop equation around here, and I have momentum conservation at each of these vertices. And these Landau equations for this subgraph are contained in the Landau equations of the full graph, right? Just because Landau equations, it tells me that go to every loop, take momentum conservation at each vertex. So the Landau equations of this small graph are really contained in the Landau equations of the full graph. So they are a subset of this. The full set of Landau equations. And now this tells me that if this subgraph does not have an alpha positive solution, then the full graph cannot also have an alpha positive solution. That's very basic, but it's very powerful because it tells you that what is the chance that one of the subgraphs does not have an alpha positive solution? It's very big. So, yeah.
Is there any combinatorial statement, something about number of vertices, loops, and edges?
Yeah, we don't know. I don't know how to quantify this statement. Yeah, I don't know how to quantify this. Yeah, I don't know. What I'm saying is something very heuristic, but it would be interesting to make this more precise. You're right. But what I want is really some argument that tells me that when I start considering large graphs, I just start I don't care about these large graphs because they become very unlikely to have a solution. So I just have a way, I just want to have a way to numerically constrain the problem such that when I go to large and larger graphs, I want to understand that these do not give me a Landau curve. So that's kind of the idea. Well, okay, so let me actually make this precise. So what is the statement here? The statement is that if you give me a large graph and I'm able to identify one of the subgraphs to be trivial, then I can show that the full graph is trivial. Okay, so that is the argument. If I can show that a subgraph is trivial, then I show that the full graph is trivial. What I mean by trivial is that it doesn't have an alpha positive solution to Landau equations. Okay? So this is really the statement. Okay, so good. So now let me just show you. So sorry, I took so long. So this is the statement is that if you take if I'm able to identify a trivial subgraph, I'm able to conclude that the whole graph is trivial. So now in practice we want to focus on the smaller subgraphs possible, right? Because these smaller subgraphs are easier to solve than Landau equations, right? So let me give you examples. Okay. Oh, sorry, I didn't show the cuts, but okay. So these are simple examples, which are purely purely graph theoretic requirements, is that you see that you can show that all of these graphs do not have an alpha positive solution. So the idea here is that, for example, applying the first criterion is that if I have two bubbles like this, if I have two bubbles, then the whole graph is trivial. So that's really the idea. I take a graph and then I tell Mathematica, search for this. If you find them, then discard the graph. Okay. So that's the idea. Okay, are there questions here? Or, okay, so then let me show you the results. So what we are going to do is take these graphs, and then we pose our criterion. We hope that the number of graphs is small enough that we can use our calculator of Landau curves. Then we increment the graphs, we make them larger, we repeat the same thing, blah blah, and then we hope that at the end you just get zero. That you don't get, as you take larger and larger graphs, you don't get more curves in this region, okay? So let me show you this happening, okay? So here in this plot, I have this curve, which you already know, right? So this plot, you see, it's between 16 and 36. And then you see that I already drew the curves we know. Okay, so this is very slim. It's like a very small, like light gray. We don't really care about these curves. I mean, we care if there is a curve going below. Okay, so for example, for the argument of the double disks having support, we want to see if there is a curve going below these elastic curves, which were the ones before. And here I'm going to show you, well, I'm going to increase the number of vertices and tell you the number of graphs and how they survive all this criterion. And then at the end, I'll show you the Landau curve. Okay. So first, we find two graphs with four vertices. It's the one we already knew and the new one. It's called the open envelope diagram. And you keep going. You find another one. Keep going. And more. Going. 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 And then you see that there's a family of curves that seems to like try to accumulate here. And I put an inset here, and you see that they are trying to get on top of each other. And then you keep going, and then you find one, 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 and then we didn't find zero. So at the end, you always find one curve, which is on this family of diagrams. And they are all really on top of these curves here. I cannot draw them already here. You cannot see them, but they are really on top of this curve. So our expectation was wrong, that there is a finite number of curves. Okay, so that this is really something I think very surprising, that this number is actually infinite, seems like. Okay, so that there is a family of curves that somehow survive this criterion of cuts and trivial subgraphs. And this come out automatically. See here, I start with 3.5 million graphs. I impose this criterion. And then three of them survive, and one of them has a solution. Okay. So and here in this table, I'm showing this crossing symmetric point, so S equals T. And just to tell you, like the approach is kind of seems like a geometric approach, okay, to this like to this accumulation. And there is a part here in the table which I didn't put. It seems like if you look at this table, it seems like I already know the answer. What is the endpoint? And in fact, where is this diagram? This diagram, the first diagram I drew with this curve, it's not there, right? So where is it? The point is that we started with quartic graphs, so with quartic vertices. And this has a sextic vertex here. So we have to keep going and now consider sextic graphs and repeat the same thing. Okay, so that's what you do. And the first one is really this graph here. And what you find is that it really is on top of this accumulation. So this seems like this is the accumulating, I mean, this seems like to be the endpoint, this accumulation. And then you keep going, you find another one, then here you really find zero. So at this point, you have 2.5 million graphs, and all the criterion just tell you that they are not have a solution. Okay. So yes, so this was, so in summary, I'm sorry for being late. So the summary is that you have this, we find this non-planar triangle chain of diagrams, which asymptote accumulate to this, to accumulate to this diagram from above. So you see that these non-planar iterations is 1, 3, 5, these are all the odd. So these are the non-planar iterations. And the planar iterations accumulate from below. So I mean, it seems like suggestive that as you increase the number of triangles, seems like just it's like just having these three particles going like in parallel. But this is just very graphically suggested. We don't have any proof. OK, so that was it. Sorry, yeah.
Can you just explain again on this last example of the triangle? Where is the cut with the four particles? It looks that you have so many legs.
Yeah. So that's why the criterion, yeah, that's the thing. The criterion tells you that you can cut through all the legs with four particle cuts. And that's true. I can just make four particle cuts like this.
Can you show? But you need many four particle cuts.
Yeah.
Not two four particle cuts.
No, you need many. I mean, it's all the four particle. You mean all the four particle cuts? Yeah. I mean, these guys. Yeah. Clear that I cannot with two cuts. I cannot cut through all the legs. I need. But just that's the statement. Is that you take all the four particle cuts and then you cut through them. And here, I mean, these guys. That's why they're a triangle. The triangle pattern is very interesting because it allows you to like go diagonally and cut them in the S channel always. And then these are just in the T channel. So, yeah. I mean. We couldn't think about, I mean, all the other ones we thought, we drew them, and people in the 60s also drew them. Yeah, these ones we really could not imagine them. Yeah. Yeah.
So we have positive, asking about old results now.
Yeah.
In the region below the second curve.
Yeah.
You
don't know, but it's a good question. So people wondered about this in the past, if you could have a positive raw all the way. And Martin showed in, I think it was 62, that if you have a positive spectral density, your cross-section decays at large energy. And we know that proton-proton scattering has a growing cross-section. So, yeah. Yeah. It's just that it's not a universal fact. Yeah, I mean, maybe. Yeah, we don't know if it's positive or not, but it cannot be true always. Yeah. So yeah. So just a small conclusion is that you see that there is no curves below this, so we believe that we found the support of rho. Yeah. The support? It's just these curves. Just those curves. Yeah. Just these two. Yeah. There is nothing here, appears to be. I mean, we have, in principle, we should go to more numerical diagrams and but like increase the numerics, but yeah. But yeah, I think we have a convincing argument.
Maybe let's ask more of these questions, Ash.
Yeah. Thank you.